You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, June 17th, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live from the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. We just nailed that, my friend.
We did.
Nailed the intro.
We may have prepared a little bit beforehand, but we nailed it.
We may have spent most of our time preparing for that beforehand.
In fact, we have no stories for you. We are completely unprepared for our Bill Sher interview. No, we're just joking here.
That was the prepared part. On today's show, the liberal grudge match is NSA surveillance, data mining justified or not? Bill Sher, the executive editor of Liberal Oasis and a longtime friend of the Majority Report, will make the case. He will share his perspective with us.
Very nice.
And Matt Binder and I will listen skeptically. And
we'll definitely consider
engage in civil debate. Actually, we have his piece. He wrote a piece in The Week magazine, making the case for NSA surveillance, the liberal case for NSA surveillance. I'd recommend everybody give it a read. Bill will make a good case. This will be a good discussion. Tons more on the show today. Huge news from the Middle East. There was a big election in Iran. We are funding the Syrian rebels, giving them even more weaponry and artillery. What else is going on, dude?
What do we got today? We got a lot. Rick Scott doing great things, such as banning paid sick leave in Florida. We got this breaking case from SCOTUS, where they strike down citizenship provisions.
That's good.
In Arizona's voter law.
Very good news there.
And we got plenty more.
Tons more. Folks, we need to get right to it. We'll be right back with Bill Sher, and we'll be right back in just a second. Welcome back, folks. I'm Michael Brooks.
And I am Matt Binder.
And joining us now is Bill Sher. He's a columnist for The Week magazine, and the executive editor of Liberal Oasis. Hey, Bill, how are you?
I'm good. Great to be back on. I'm sad not to be on when Sam's here. I'm sure Sam would love to talk to me about this subject.
Probably you'll get a little bit more of a gentle treatment from us.
yes, that's very true.
Truth be told. But full disclosure, I've actually known Bill for a couple years myself and also consider you a friend. And this is the first time, or actually the second time we've done something like this. So this will be fun. So Bill, just to start us off, you wrote this piece in The Week basically making the liberal case for high-tech NSA surveillance. What is the case? Why don't you give us a summary of your argument?
Look, I'm one of those liberals who remembers the Bush days when we were upset that he was not focused on al-Qaeda, that he was going into neocon adventures into Iraq and saying, you took your eye off the ball at Tora Bora, and you let Osama run into the mountains. And I'm still in that same place. Let's focus on actual threats and not bogus threats. But to go back to the point of the article that I wrote, the big picture, liberalism at its core believes in the use of government for the common good. I think good liberals can disagree on how that should be used. I'm not saying I'm not the keeper of the flame here. I'm saying there is a case to make that when you're dealing with an actual threat that's actually harming the common good, actually harming public safety, it is not illiberal, it is not authoritarian or fascist to say, okay, how do I address the problem of clandestine terrorist agents plotting to kill us, which is actually happening, it's not made up. And if we can do that in a way that does not infringe upon our freedom, like what often happens in America, I mean, the history is bad. And I understand someone saying, because of this bad history, because of the communist witch hunts, because of COINTELPRO in the 60s, because of Japanese internment camps, because of Palmer raids, I don't trust the government with this data. I get the argument, and I don't think it's a bad argument. But what I have seen over the last 10 years of this program being in existence, so not theoretical, not hypothetical, what's actually happened is that this program has been used to pinpoint actual terrorists and not mass scapegoat and not abuse privacy. I mean, if we had one example of the data being abused, I think the other side would have a better argument. But we haven't seen that in 10 years. I see that the net result of this is being a much better record on civil liberties and personal freedom and much better pinpointing on the actual problem. That's why I come down on the side of supporting the current program.
All right, so let's just disaggregate a few things here, I think really briefly, that are kind of important to establish. So no one here is recommending or suggesting or arguing, certainly not Matt or I or Sam, that al-Qaeda isn't a legitimate threat, that there isn't actual threats in this realm that need to be addressed. So I think, that kind of aspect of the argument, and that there isn't, legitimate uses of law enforcement, intelligence, and all the rest to monitor, track, and avert those attacks. So that can kind of be tabled. But then you're kind of getting into this other terrain where you're saying, okay, so this program has never been abused. And in fact, it's been successful. I don't see clear evidence on either of those two fronts. One, I mean, this program is so secretive and so closed. Loretta Sanchez said last week that we are just finding out literally the tip of the iceberg of what we know about this just from what we've been disclosed so far. And then you put that in conjunction with the historical examples you raise, which are very important, but also areas that maybe haven't been directly linked to the program, but are certainly current, like police departments coordinating with the FBI to invasively monitor Occupy Wall Street, nonviolent environmental activists getting monitored, anti-fracking people showing up on, private intelligence agents, private intelligence firms working for the state of Pennsylvania, and then also kind of FBI entrapment cases of basically simpletons, kind of setting them up on these sort of ludicrous terror plots, that, you know, have been kind of conducted and orchestrated the whole way through by the FBI. So it seems like we don't really know, and there's plenty in the broader environment that would suggest that a lot of these things are subject and to abuse right now.
Well, I'm not saying it's an airtight case. I think there is an argument against it. You know, it comes down to a certain degree of trust based on recent evidence. Which way do you go? If you're going to conflate FBI stuff and NYPD stuff with the NSA, which I'm not putting words in your mouth, I think you're saying we don't know if they're connected. If you want to presume the worst and that they are connected, I can see coming out on the other side. I feel like even though this is a pretty secret program, there's all sorts of secrets that we have learned in the past 8 years. There's all sorts of things we weren't supposed to know right away that get out. You know, there's plannings about the drone program, plannings about torture in the Bush administration. There's plenty of stuff. And anything that's controversial inside the government, it's a lot easier for that stuff to leak out now than 50 years ago when the press was a much more of a closed circle. There's now many more places for leaks to go. I would suspect if someone had the goods on actual NSA abuse, we already know people inside the NSA that aren't happy about this on philosophical grounds who have leaked. Those folks have not leaked actual abuse yet. So until I see that, I'm not going to presume it. And I also believe that if that does come out, it violates current law, and I think it would be addressed under current law. It wouldn't be accepted by the public. So I don't see how the program itself can't be managed, can't be safeguarded. The basic concept of metadata collection that cannot be accessed with additional court approval doesn't strike me as a violation of the Fourth Amendment, and it strikes me as an effective way to deal with the third terrorist threat.
Bill, doesn't it bother you though? Like, okay, your argument is that they need this extra approval for someone like, you know, the FBI or the NYPD to be able to access this information, the metadata, the phone records, the online history. But I mean, we have, for example, how can I put this? I mean, evidence of so many of these private contractors. Just with Edward Snowden, he was a private contractor for Booz Allen Hamilton, and he was able to access this information. And I mean, don't you think there's a problem that there's all these private contractors who have this information? I believe there's must be tens of thousands of private contractors from even low level to high level who have access to this giant amount of information.
Yeah, and I would just add to that parenthetically, because I've said on the show, and some people disagree with me, but I'm very supportive of the NSA leaks, but I don't like the hacking leaks at all. And I think, you know, a good case could be made. Why is that coming out, and who is being trusted with this degree of information?
And that's a whole separate issue. I don't want to and I agree with you, Michael, but I don't want to get off the point that Matt is making. Well, I mean, it is possibly problematic that there are more people who have access to this than they should. And I imagine this leak is sparking that exact conversation within the NSA and within the White House. I have no problem with there being, there should be oversight. There should be congressional briefings. There should be constant monitoring of the program. There shouldn't be a blasé attitude about it. Don't worry, it's all going to be all right. There should be a degree of discomfort that we have so things don't go off the rails. But I think that you can have that concern and still feel like the program is generally a good idea but needs to be, you know, continually monitored and refined than to say this is a fatal flaw in the program, therefore it should not be done at all.
Well, okay, so then actually I want to get back on two things. One, I think that's – you said earlier sort of about, you know, if there had been clearer abuses, they probably would have been leaked. Now, I would say by that same token, and we could see this with the drone program. So, yes, there's been different types of leaks about the drone program, some of them incredibly critical of it. And the administration itself has leaked a lot about the drone program to make them, you know, look good. So I think by the same token, if you want to say more abuses probably would have been leaked, I'm going to say more success stories from this would have been leaked. And the argument that people like Thomas Drake and Snowden obviously would make is that they do think that this level of coordination and oversight and information gathering is intrinsically an overreach on the Fourth Amendment. And I have to say, I mean, it seems like the administration hasn't had to address this through a legal technicality of people not having standing in court. But that's the fundamental point of the leak so far, right? That this is a grand violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Well, man, that's a fundamental, I think, just different philosophical view. Does the collection itself amount to this grievous violation of privacy that violates the Fourth Amendment? And, you know, people just have different opinions about that. If you think the current program violates the Fourth Amendment, you have a recourse for that. You can sue. The agency is putting the lawsuit together. You have to get the Supreme Court eventually to agree with your interpretation for it to actually be decreed unconstitutional. And I see Glenn Greenwald make this case that how dare the administration strike down these types of lawsuits on technical grounds, try to demonstrate their technical grounds and succeed? Well, guess what? That's the law game.
But Bill, the point is not that
if you can't find enough judges to agree with your view, then your view is not law. That's just sometimes you just lose the argument. That happens in life.
Well, I mean, Dred Scott was a law. I mean, I don't know what that means. I'm not demonizing the Obama administration. And if you want, like, distinguish between, you know, myself and someone like Greenwald, I have no personal antipathy towards Obama at all. I voted for him twice, but I don't think that it is a loophole argument, and therefore the case has not gone through a process. I mean, isn't that the kind of main takeaway?
I mean, I understand that, as a technical matter, yes, you're correct, but if you can't find a single judge on the district level or five judges at the Supreme Court level to say, yes, you as an American citizen have basic standing to deal with this issue, and because of that, your concerns on privacy grounds are absolutely valid, and this program should be struck down. If you can't make that case to a judge, I mean, at the end of the day, Under the Constitution, if the concern is what's following the Constitution, well, part of the Constitution is the judicial branch decides these questions. If you can't get the judicial branch to decide the question, then your constitutional view is not carrying the day. And if we got to the merits, the clause in the Constitution is unreasonable searches and seizures. There is a qualifier there, unreasonable. We just had a case about DNA swabs that was 5-4. It scrambled the ideological composition of the court, but the five said taking a DNA swab of someone when they're arrested for a serious crime and then using that information to charge them with another crime is reasonable. Scalia and some of the other liberal justices vehemently disagreed, but they didn't have five, so they lost. You can have debates about how the Constitution is interpreted. I have one view about the Fourth. Do you have another view about the Fourth? If you're going to win, you got to get five Supreme Court justices on your side, and that includes the technical preliminary questions as well.
How is, like, you mentioned the ACLU bringing up the case, though, but how are these cases supposed to be brought up and won by these people before these leaks came out? I mean, how do you fight a secret prism, and how do you fight these secret policies with that when you can't? I mean, over 500, almost 500 cases have been dismissed from court for secrecy or lack of standing because of these reasons. I mean, how do they fight these things?
It'll be very frustrating to be the ACLU on this question. I don't think they're going to win this case. I don't think they're going to win on the standing question. And if they did that, I don't think they're going to win on the merits.
But then don't you see
their job? They're going to try. But and if you can't win there, if you feel this is a rigged game and the judicial branch is just too deferential and ask security questions, you can't win there. Well, your other avenue is the legislative branch. And if you can't get Congress to agree with you there, then if you lose for all three branches, then how do you accept the result that you cause a revolution? I mean, those are supposed to be options that are left. And I hear folks on the opposite side of me saying, well, Ron Wyden says this, and Mark Udall says this. That's great. You need a majority. They are two people. I think they're sincere people. But if they can get their colleagues to agree with them, they're not the voice of the entire Congress or the American people. At some point, point, you have to actually win the argument within the system we have. And if you don't like that, then you got to overhaul the whole system.
But then how do you win over the legislative branch, though, when, like you said, when they don't even know what's going on? I mean, you have Jeff Merkley out there last week saying how this is the first he's heard of these things. And then it came out that he missed one of the one hearing that they had on it. And he just happened to not be there for that one hearing. I mean, isn't there a problem when these secret things that, all right, one hearing and they didn't tell them what was going to be discussed? If these Congress people are not there to know what's going on, or they just aren't being told about it, how are you supposed to win over the legislative branch if you fail with the judicial branch?
I mean, if I'm a legislator and I'm not being properly briefed, and that angers me, and a majority of my colleagues feel the same way, we can pass a law saying you're not properly briefing us, you've gone rogue, this program is hereby null and void. They're allowed to do that. It seems to me that most Congress people don't feel that way.
Well, but Bill,
they haven't properly briefed and don't want to sit down the program. That's just a disagreement. If you don't like the way the Congress is structured, you've got to rally the public around the question to change the Congress. I think, and I'm not saying this means I'm right and you're wrong, but I do feel that people are making assertions about what's legal and what's constitutional, and individuals are not the final arbiter of that. You have to convince folks to pass laws that clarify things to your way, or convince judges otherwise, for that argument to carry the day.
Right, but Bill, I mean, look. Okay, so I think, again, I think some things are getting conflated. I think that obviously a fuller hearing on the merits of the case have not been heard because of a technicality. Now, we can debate, you know, whether or not that's legitimate, and that's what the court has found, and, you know, what would happen if it actually was heard. But that full case has not been heard. Then you have legislators who I think, you know, I don't think it's ascribing negative intentions to people. I just think, like, look, maybe your main incentive is, I don't really care about anything else. I don't want to kind of deal with the burdens of oversight of this program. I just never want to be held responsible for another terrorist attack. That is my singular political motivation. I'm not weighing and balancing other things. I guess and then you could sort of talking about what's legal here, but I think that, you know, that's a related point, which is that many of us who opposed the Patriot Act, the point was we don't want some of these things to become legal, right? So there's also just the substantive question there too. But I think that don't you think that there's a little bit of an override here when it's like, if you have three branches and you have the judicial branch, which isn't engaging because of a well-crafted loophole, then you have, you know, the executive branch, no matter what, the executive branch is going to have the desire to sort of hold things close to the vest and take a certain degree of power. And then you have the legislative branch, which, look, not just judging by what people like Wyden and Udall say, I'm talking about Loretta Sanchez or, you know, John Tester, who's on the Homeland Security Committee, saying, we didn't know we didn't have any idea what the hell was going on. Now, either that means they're not properly informed by who's briefing them, and obviously, like, Clapper lying to Wyden the other week isn't a good indication of how they're being briefed. Or it means that, sure, you know, these people aren't taking their duties responsibly. So in any scenario,
this is really serious stuff. I'm sorry?
I'm just saying, in any scenario, these are very major policy implications of these things, and they're not getting fully vetted.
If you believe that the co-equal branches of government are having this kind of, you know, triple fail because of the nature of national security that makes it next to impossible for the gears of government to work as they should, and there's a systematic constitutional breakdown, and the result of that is leading us towards, you know, a disaster of an Orwellian state.
I no words, Orwellian disaster. I'm definitely not using any of those words. So
okay,
let's just be clear.
I don't know what you're talking about, but at least my point. If this is so horrible that the result is such a disaster for us, then look, then you have to do something about the entire system. You got to start from ground zero. If you don't feel it's that dire, then maybe this privacy violation is not that dire. Maybe it's not great. Maybe it's not your favorite thing in the world. You disagree with it. But just if I'm Edward Snowden, for example, is this so bad that I want to risk incarcerating myself for 30 years on this subject because it's so important. I mean, he thinks it was. He made a rational decision that this was a fair trade. I'm concerned for him that perhaps he might look back 30 years from now while he's taking a prison cell, say, maybe I didn't weigh the pros and cons properly, or maybe I disagree with it, but it wasn't the best. But that's the judgment we all have to make. And I'm happy that we're discussing this. I don't think we should be blasé about the subject. But I think there's a lot of overwrought, slippery slope type of arguments being used. I don't think jive with the reality.
But wait. So let's back up to this though, right? Let's get to the slippery slope argument. So if we're codifying these things. And you actually acknowledge in your piece that down the road, a system like this could certainly be abused by, I think, political hack was one of the phrases you used. And I think arguably systems like this were, certainly abused in the Bush era where they didn't even bother to get FISA permission to do this type of thing. Do we want to codify this type of incredibly extensive program with, again, I just think you'd have to say objectively relatively little oversight for administrations to come, even if you totally have full trust in this one? I don't think that's a slippery slope argument. I think that's an institutional argument. And we are supposed to, at the end of the day, be an institutional.
The slippery slope is the assumption that you're going to swallow it down to the bottom. I don't assume that if we have a national gun registry, that the government's going to abuse that data. I don't assume that because we have Medicare and Social Security, that the government's going to abuse that data. There's some people on the far right that do. I consider that there needs to be grievous privacy violations. I don't. I think the evidence has shown that we can handle that sort of data and not lead it to abuse.
Okay, so then
I understand from having a different view about that, but I don't. And again, I'm not saying like I'm liberal and you're not. I'm saying there is a liberal case to make here. That this is as good a use of government as it would be to have a gun sale database.
Okay, so then let me have a quick policy question about that. So yeah, I don't think concerns about this program and privacy is in any, because making a phone call is not the same type of public activity as buying an assault rifle. So I don't buy that it's equidistant to begin with. But okay, let's say we wanted to draw that analogy. So in the gun bill, which, you and I probably think this is totally useless and unnecessary, but they put an amendment in the gun bill saying these registries could never be used for anything else besides this. And if they are, there's going to be major consequences. So what would be wrong with introducing something like that into the NSA process? Safeguards like that.
I don't have a problem with that. My understanding is there's lots of laws in the books that already don't allow you to take people's private data without court approval and use to politically blackmail them or otherwise intimidate them. I don't believe it's currently legal. So if you need more safeguards to ensure that the law gets followed, again, I'm not opposed to that. But that's reforming or refining the current program and not abolishing it.
Right, but that goes along, and this is where it connects, I think, to two larger issues outside of the kind of very kind of granular detail of this. And actually, one is we both accepted, and all three of us kind of accepted in the beginning of this conversation that there is an actual terrorist threat, there is Al Qaeda activity, and that's real, of course. Do you think though that the actual objective level of that threat within the United States, it really rises to the level of, again, justifying this level of really expansive power and monitoring?
Well, this is the Connor Friedersdorf argument. Look at the numbers. We have more deaths from diabetes. We have more deaths from gun violence. We have more deaths from drunk driving accidents. Why are we so overwrought about terrorism? If someone has the view that this is an overhyped threat, it induces panic unnecessarily. We could have a more British attitude, keep calm and carry on, stiff upper lip, and everything would be. I mean, obviously, any death is tragic, but it's not. I'm not going to take personal responsibility for what someone else, other terrorist, does, and change how society functions because of that. I understand that argument. I think people could be more transparent about that argument if that's what they believe.
Well, that's not my argument. I mean, just to be clear, my argument is this is a threat, And it does have its own, and it's not equivalent to something like diabetes, because the things to address this are fundamentally different than addressing diabetes. But the question, again, is a question of scale. That's the question. It's not a question of, you know, of oh, well, let's just carry on and not worry about it. It's a question of scale. And then, and as an addendum to that, which brings back the realm of private contractors and how we're even defining these terms, which is also an important part of this debate, is, you know, the real concern, again, maybe it's not political blackmail, but it's how, you know, several years from now, we already look at, you know, Occupy people getting, you know, monitored in these absurd ways by local police departments and things like this. You know, basically some nice hippies protesting income inequality, and they're getting their Facebook pages looked at, and they're getting their addresses, you know, accounted. And we know that, you know, companies like agribusinesses are trying to criminalize going undercover and, you know, filming abusive work or animal rights conditions. So what happens?
I mean, I think there's some conflating going on there. There's no argument that NSA has infiltrated Occupy or NSA has worked in league with agribusiness. You know,
there's absolutely no reason to assume that this level of information and coordination can easily, especially when you look actually and take the NSA out of it. What about the level of reliance on private contractors whose businesses overlap in all of these different areas? And they certainly do contracts at all of these various types of levels and with a variety of different types of clients.
If they're sharing that information, if the NSA is sharing information with the FBI like that and NYPD, they're breaking the law. They're breaking current law that's not supposed to be used for that. Mm-hmm. So if that's found out, I would hope they find it out and they'll still get prosecuted. That's against the law. But to go back to your previous argument, is this an overreach relative to the threat? And I mean, you could judge that based on number of casualties and say this is not that many casualties at the end of the day, so we shouldn't, you know, go overboard on this. But I think there's another element to the assessment, which is anytime there's any kind of terrorist attack, even if it's small in nature, it does produce a psychological reaction with the public that can have other kinds of substantive effects.
Yes, like in Boston, which this program missed.
What's that?
Like in Boston, which this program missed. So the argument for me more would be, what are the actual techniques and tools that really work in this regard of addressing terrorism?
Well, I don't think it's fair to judge a program if it didn't bat 1,000. I mean, I think we have to have some. Mm-hmm. The question is, did we do all we could in that instance to try to address that threat? I think what I've read about Boston so far is that they did all they could. They didn't throw data away that they could have used. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's fair to say, I mean, if we're going to take that one instance that this proves NSA program sucks, well, that doesn't account for all the plots they may have taken out. And I know there's debate about about the evidence there too, but you want to have all the evidence before you make a premature judgment whether it's effective or not. But we're not largely debating the effectiveness, we're debating the philosophy and the appropriateness of doing it at all. And I think that any kind of terrorist attack has such a negative reaction societally that the public is going to demand a response, and is not going to sit back and treat it like, you know, a run-of-the-mill crime. The public is going to demand that their government do something to prevent these sorts of things, and I think rightly so. I mean, if you want to try to induce a mass cultural shift in people's attitudes to this, that doing this in an aggressive way is not necessary, be my guest. But I think people, especially when soft targets are being hit, it makes them feel like this could happen on my block any day of the week, and I want to see my government do something to prevent that from happening if at all possible. I don't think it's an irrational response.
And I guess just final question: do you think that these disclosures are performing a positive function in some sense, because this debate should be had and there should be a broader discussion regardless of where you come down on it?
Well, it's hard to fully weigh that because you don't know to what extent you damage the program with the leak. You know, some people have argued that, well, you know, terrorists weren't using the cell phones anyway. And so who cares if this just shows how ineffective the program is? Well, from what I understand, again, I'm not a national security expert. I'm not a former NSA contractor. But from what I understand, you know, they're smart terrorists and they're dumb terrorists. You know, Osama bin Laden was using a courier because he was smart enough not to go online. But you know, Tamerlan, you know, had a YouTube channel showing Al-Qaeda videos. You know, some people are not that bright. Look, I've been on Tamla's YouTube channel. I've watched the Al Qaeda video there.
Yeah,
they
me
have
too.
To come and get me. Yeah, because you do one thing, that doesn't mean they're going to just lock you up. You want to get a collection of data that shows the pattern of behavior. And it's obviously unfortunate that it didn't work.
Wait, so Bill, if you were on that YouTube channel?
I'm sorry?
You were on that YouTube channel, Bill?
I was on Tamerlan's YouTube channel. I'm still in here. They haven't made me.
You might be getting a visit.
Hey, Bill, I know that you need to run now, but I really appreciate your time, and I think it's a worthwhile debate and discussion.
I agree. Thanks for talking.
Thanks. Take care.
I got to say, I mean, I don't agree with what he has to say.
Mm-hmm.
But from that article that I read, I was like completely ready to, really fight back. But he came here and he gave his case. I thought he gave it very well. I don't agree, but
yeah, I was ready. I was ready. I was like on trying to like say. I thought you were gonna jump at him.
There was a little bit more. Where I was trying to get something, but he was ready and he was good and he put his points forward and I'll hand it to him for that, definitely.
Well, all of these debates, what was happening is it's like, how do you set the parameters of what you're talking about? And if you pretty much say, you may not like that courts haven't heard it, but they haven't heard it. So that's it. There's nothing to see here. And you may not like how, and I actually think every time when I talk with Bill, I was thinking of like Chris Hayes has this idea of institutionalists versus insurrectionists. And institutionalists, basically, they fundamentally trust in our institutional frameworks. And insurrectionists, kind of don't. And, I think for us, I'll speak for me personally. I don't see I know Edward Snowden says I'm like the architecture of oppression or whatever. And I don't see that. What I see is a massive boondoggle filled with contractors responding on a scale to a real threat, but in a, completely disproportionate way that could be easily abused. I mean, one of the things I didn't bring up because, again, we don't know this stuff, but the NSA coordinates with British, equivalent of the NSA.
There's a story that just came out where the Dutch a former Dutch intelligence analyst with their intelligence firm, intelligence agency, right. AIVD, he said they could request the PRISM data and 5 minutes later they'd receive it from the U.S.
Well, and in the British case, it's possible, again, this is speculation, but it's not baseless speculation. If you looked at the British equivalent of the NSA, which we'll get to in a second with these new disclosures, they work closely. They might say you could call up Britain and say, hey, are you monitoring these calls we can't make in the United States? Yeah. Can we take a look at them? Sure. Are you monitoring these calls in Britain that we can't monitor? There's all of these endless loopholes. And I got to say, I think that the assertion that there's a bunch of foiled plots that the, NSA can't disclose or, the intelligence apparatus can't disclose because of security considerations, incredibly hard pill to swallow. I mean, the amount of security successes that have been leaked that make everybody look good, including stuff now that's getting, things that were leaked about Bin Laden, the Bin Laden raid using like fake polio vaccine doctors. Polio vaccine doctors are getting killed in Pakistan like right now because of those leaks. So I think that's really dubious. If there was a clear case where this actually did it, we would have heard about it.
I wanted to bring up he almost went there at the end, but he didn't quite, so I didn't bring it up. But you can't say that these leaks, these leaks disclose information that is detrimental to national security, destroys these programs. I mean, he almost went there with the stupid terrorist thing who used their phone. But that's not quite the same. But and then saying that, oh, but we all knew about this anyway. I mean, you can't say that.
No, that's a mutually contradictory position. I mean, that's absolutely true. And then, the only thing I would say in defense of that position is, if we learned anything from all of these FBI cases against these complete morons, for these ridiculous terrorist attacks, that there are a lot of really stupid aspiring terrorists out there.
Yeah, but you know what? I think they'll screw up somewhere else if they didn't screw up by using their phone.
Right.
I mean, no, but also, I mean, I didn't bring this up with him too because he's very specific with not conflating things. So I didn't even want to bother with that.
Right.
Which is kind of, I mean, that's the way you get around.
That's the whole
things.
Tactic.
Yes.
If you can close, and I feel like that was the whole debate. Open it, and he kept trying to constrain it.
Michael actually warned me about this. Almost all of my points had to do with. He was able to skirt by saying the conflating thing.
They were all great points. Yeah. It's just that's the tactic.
But when you think about Quest, which I mentioned last week, CEO did not want to, in 2001, CEO of Quest, which was a phone company that had contracts, a telecommunications company that had contracts with the United States government, but they also had their own customer base. The government asked them to take part in their phone records program. I'm not sure if it was the same thing they're running now, but it's something similar, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And the CEO checked with his law counsel, and they said, you don't have to do this. And so he declined to help them out. And so they said, fine. They canceled all their government contracts with Quest, the company, and they proceeded to look into this guy and argue that he traded company stock based on insider information of knowing about those private government contracts, which they canceled. And they sent him to prison for 7 years. I mean,
yeah.
If you just take that and take, okay, even if you don't want to say, okay, Obama's not going to do that, or this guy was partaking in something illegal to begin with, he just happened to get caught after, you know, getting on their grid. I mean, but look at all this extra information they have now. How easily would it be for some, even if you don't believe Obama's going to do it, let's go with this argument that some future president
absolutely
will use this information for some other person, some other CEO, some other anyone who, say you're a person and you don't want to help out in some case because you don't feel like, you feel like you don't have a place to do this. And they go, you know what? We're going to look back at your information. If we find any sort of law you're breaking, we're going to hold you against that. I mean, there's, how many federal laws do you break a day without even knowing? How many laws in general do you break a day without even knowing?
Now, you probably should know that urinating on the subway tracks is illegal, Matt.
Okay, thank you. No, but I mean, there's a lot of laws break every day that they don't know they're breaking. Now imagine you tweeted or sent a Facebook message to someone stating something about that. They could use this against you in the future. You don't know who's going to get a hold of this information. Even if not that, you know, not that small. Let's say, you know, you're a CEO and you also don't want to go this route. I mean, Twitter's not taking part in this prison program because they feel very strongly about user privacy. Let's say the CEO of Twitter sent some messages to someone overseas and then they found out that that person received some sort of financing for his company from some shady group that could be linked with some sort of terrorist group. They could use that to connect the dots.
Well, I'll give you an example right now. I mean, Al Gore has been really critical of this program. He called it not really the American way, and his first tweet when this was first disclosed was that this was obscenely outrageous. Now, he sold Current to Al Jazeera, which is going to be Al Jazeera America, which I'm incredibly excited about. And I think it's going to be a great network. Now, you know, Al Jazeera is based in Qatar. The Qatari government, we have great relations with them. They do a lot of stuff that we like in the region. Well, Qatar also funds, groups like Hamas. You could do a case – I mean – That being exactly the point, you can draw all of these tenuous connections. You can make all of these, really – and it already happens. And I think that was the other – but at any rate, I mean, I think we got – I think we pinned him down on some things.
I also couldn't really – again, another thing because he would have been able to – he can't say these things haven't happened like he was saying. Like, oh, there's no proof we gave information to FBI or NYPD. There's no proof we used this against Occupy or environmentalists or animal rights groups. But – there's no proof that this program has actually stopped any terrorism.
I did say that to him. Yeah.
But I mean, he didn't really. He kind of avoided that with the but anyway, yeah. I mean, you can't say that, especially when that information is coming from the same people who do the program. I mean, we're not being told by some outside group or some secondary government group that this does. The NSA is saying this what we do works. I mean, obviously you're going to say that.
No, I mean, I think, again, you're totally right. I think what's good about that debate, and I think we were able to, pin him on some things, and I think that what's good about it is, it's good to get the smartest articulation of the opposing viewpoint.
And that's definitely
think it's a completely disingenuous argument, that's going to be like when you talk to somebody who doesn't just go 9/11, I mean, he kind of was just saying.
I mean, that's why we had like.
He was fundamentally just saying 9/11, but there was a lot of steps that got there. And those steps are important.
Speaking of 9/11, I'm sure this wasn't his doing and more the week's doing, but yeah. His article, The Liberal Case for High-Tech NSA Surveillance, the main photo, and this type of stuff bothers me so much,
right.
Is a photo of the Twin Towers being hit by the planes. I mean, come on now. If that isn't like, you know, Bush fear tactics 101, Bush era fear tactics 101, I mean, come on now. The liberal case for – I mean, again, this isn't Bill Scheer's doing, but I mean, his argument obviously gave the photo editor, the editor of the week, the you know, oh, let's use this. It works with his article.
No, and it's really crass. And it's – and again, like, you know, the whole intelligence failures and system that led to 9/11 happening, or, you know, is it just a completely – it's a totally different conversation. But anyways, there you have it, folks. I think we'll take a really brief break.
You might know. Let's go right into the new leaks.
All right. All right. So this just came out yesterday. This is the kind of new batch of Edward Snowden leaks. Again, I don't think that this is particularly surprising, but it connects with some interesting stuff that was actually revealed back, I think, in 2004. That around the lead up to the invasion of Iraq. But basically, the government communication headquarters, which is the UK equivalent of the NSA, set up extensive spying operations on delegates attending the G20 summit in 2009 in London. And as you know, we remember, that was a really big summit, because that was basically like, you know, Obama was coming to Europe. He had just, you know, pretty recently been elected. The world economy was imploding, and Gordon Brown, who was in major political trouble then as the British UK Prime Minister, was really staking his political future on the kind of success of this summit. So I'll just read a few quotes from the article. Foreign officials who took part in the G20 summit meetings in London in 2009 had their computers monitored and their phone calls intercepted on the instruction of their British government hosts. And here's how they did it. They set up internet cafes where they used email encryption programs and key logging software to spy on delegates' uses of computers. They penetrated the security on delegates' BlackBerries to monitor their emails and phone calls. They supplied 45 analysts with an around-the-clock summary of who was phoning who at the summit. And they targeted the Turkish finance minister and possibly 15 other people in his party. And then the document suggests that the operation was sanctioned at the highest levels, and they, you know, it was very, very extensive, and that the information was regularly passed on to ministers. Now, you know, and I just think this is fascinating, because I think when we think about something like the G20 summit, it's kind of like, oh my God, they all show up, they all have a big meal, they all come in their motorcades, and they release, you know, occasionally some important policy, but it's a lot of kind of pomp and circumstance, and, you know, if you're interested in that sort of thing, fine. But this is actually, you know, what's going on around it. This reminded Juan Cole, who we had on last week, of a report from 2009, which is even more explosive than this, actually, which is that the British and American governments, the Blair and Bush governments, were spying on top UN officials and UN delegations in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq. And actually, one cabinet member in Tony Blair's government who resigned because of the invasion, she revealed that while in the cabinet, she'd seen transcripts of Kofi Annan's telephone calls. He's the former UN Secretary General. And it turns out that whenever, you remember Hans Blix, who was the UN weapons inspector in Iraq, whenever he was on calls, his cell phone was monitored. Blix was under surveillance, and transcripts of his calls were shared among the US, UK, Australia, and Canada. And this put some weight to Blix's claim he had been the subject of a political smear campaign, which is another thing, you know, that people like Bill are really minimizing with this stuff. I mean, what, you know, the notion that there isn't, you know, political consequences of this type of monitoring seems kind of naive at best. And then the other aspect of those revelations from 2004, which kind of work in the opposite direction, is it belies even more how dishonest Bush and Blair were being about WMDs, because that would mean that they would be even more privy to the conversations that Blix and Anon and other monitors were having, showing that, you know, Iraq was not in possession of those weapons. So I think, you know, the and it's amazing because there's another G20, there's another summit happening right now. And this is like a, you know, another, you know, the hacking thing was timed right before the meeting with the new Chinese premier, and this is, you know, timed right before the summit in the UK. So that's interesting stuff. And I go to Juan Call's website and look up the previous reporting he cited around the lead up to Iraq invasion. This stuff is very, it's very real. It's definitely a, you know, part of how politics gets done. So
it's just another, I mean, additional, I mean, I'm sure more will, I know more will come out.
Yeah, no, yeah, of course. Of course more will come out. So, and part of what is on, and it's actually, it's not a G20 summit, it's a G8 summit, I should correct myself. It's going on in the UK. Another big item on the agenda is Syria. And last week, we're going to go to the better half now.
I'm sorry,
folks, I was confused. We're going to go to the better half. And so we got Syria, we got Iran, we've got unbelievable.
We got Rick Perry. I have a complete, you know, Rick Perry. You just got to listen to this. I mean, if you're not a member, this Rick Perry takedown I'm about to do is pretty good.
It's epic.
I prepared this well. And we also got
Rick Perry is getting the Ben Shapiro treatment from Matt.
Yeah. But also we got Rick Scott, speaking of Republican Ricks. he just signed a bill.
A douchebag.
Banning paid sick leave. He did it right now for a very specific reason. We also have more about the NSA leaks. We have we just got a lot of stuff, and you should become a member and come listen to it.
Yeah, and we're going to go a little bit later today for members, folks, because we don't have a show tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow there'll be no show.
Yes.
No show at all. On Wednesday, we're going to have some recorded new stuff for you guys that Sam recorded. And then Thursday and Friday, Sam will be live at Netroots.
With just the guests that we already have planned are just crazy. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Become a member, please. Buy your stuff through our Amazon link.
It's amazing how much content we get. It's amazing. It really is. I mean, really, if you're a member, you get so, like I can't even remember a day we actually completely took off like that on tomorrow. Like, neither that never I. happens. We're literally just doing that because Sam is preparing for Netroots. And we're going to help with getting that preparations going.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, you get so much. And even if you cannot afford to become a member, you can support the show in a myriad of other ways, such as going to our majority.fm, clicking the Amazon link that's on the front page now, bookmarking it, and doing all your Amazon shopping through that link. We get a small kickback, as Sam says. Very small kickback, but those kickbacks add up. And you can also support this show by subscribing to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Sam Cedar, and subscribing to the YouTube live stream feed, which is youtube.com/Majority Report Live. And be sure to watch everything. Even if you listen to the show already, watch the video. Share the videos with your friends. We make a little bit from YouTube, too. All these little kickbacks help out.
And you get, like, a conversation going about the show.
Exactly.
And why shouldn't there be?
Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/majority report. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/majority FM. Call into the show at?
Let me see. Right here. Oh, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920.
And you could do that starting right now as we go to the better half.
All right. We'll be back in a bit. So you...
Hey.